happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location. Nice to have you with us. We're going to talk about how the Hospital for Sick Children in Ontario found that on and off fasting, periodic fasting, helps fight obesity. And there's an epidemic of that, so that's good information and easy to follow. I'll go into that. And how biblical spice, tested as a possible breast and prostate cancer treatment from Medical University of South Carolina. And then we're going to explore how stress might be just as unhealthy as junk food for your digestive system, Brigham Young University, and how researchers find that zinc, this very important mineral, its binding capacity is vital for regulating the pH levels in the brain. And that's from the Center for Molecular Medicine in Norway, and a lot more on health and healing. Then I'm going to have a separate discussion on the environment, what's happening, what we can do about it. And some people have been concerned about the posturing with a war against Iran. I will share why we are turning as a nation to accept that, especially the Beltway pundits, those who benefit from conflict, and why they're wrong on each point. We should not have a war with anyone right now. Also, time permitting, the politics of mass incarceration. Shouldn't we just take a moment and stop this whole non-conscious way of functioning and ask, what is the purpose of incarceration? Someone has done something that we're not happy with, that shows they're not able or not willing to coexist peacefully within a society. All right, how does that reconcile with the current industrial complex, the incarceration complex? What happens when over one half of all the people in prison, by administrators' own admission, should not be there? Then why are they? Why is our judicial system so corrupted in its philosophies, so lacking in ethics? How did we get here? What can we do to get out of this mess? And there's a volcano in the United States that could literally wipe out life on Earth. And we thought it would be a long time coming, maybe 100,000 years. Well, according to the latest research, not true. And so we're going to take a moment to look at what's happening at Yellowstone National Park in this mega volcano that is showing absolutely tremendous amount of eruptions, mini eruptions, and what that means. And the earthquakes around it, what that means, and how it could be here a lot sooner in our lifetimes even. We'll explore that. The big issue of the day is, what do you believe we should be doing to bring peace to the Middle East? I believe any responsible and reasonable and spiritual person realizes that continuing the conflict as it is, where the Palestinians and the Israelis are not able to coexist, is a detriment to both. I believe we should want and seek a peaceful solution so both people can live in peace. But we then tend to align ourselves, either on one side or the other. Abby Martin went to Israel. She spoke mainly, almost exclusively, to Israeli citizens about what they believe is the problem. She did not identify her own opinion, not once. She was simply asking them for theirs. I'm then going to ask, what do you make of this when you hear one side of an issue? What are your opinions? That'll be our talk back segment. What do you believe is the solution? 888-874-8888 is our talk back number. 888-874-8888. So that's our program today. And I have a guest that will be coming on at some point. They're calling in, so we don't know when, and that'll be Professor Thomas Frank. He is a political analyst and a historian of cultural ideas, and he is a columnist for The Guardian and a former columnist for Harper's Magazine and The Wall Street Journal. And he's going to talk about the demise of the Democratic Party and American liberalism, and is reform possible? And as soon as he calls in, we'll go to him after the halfway mark. For health and nutrition, up to 16 weeks of intermittent fasting without otherwise having to count calories helps fight obesity and metabolic disorders that can include heart disease and diabetes. And such fasting already shows benefits in 6 weeks, tremendous benefits. That's according to the peer-reviewed journal Cell Research, which published the intermittent fasting study. So here's the takeaway message. If you were to simply one day a week reduce your caloric intake to half of what it normally would be, let's say if you're at 3,000 calories, you go to 1,500, two go to 1,000 calories for that day. Now you can have your protein shakes, you can have juices, salads, smoothies, but you really limit it. You could be extending your lifespan, losing weight, and helping prevent heart disease. There is some research completed at Medical University of South Carolina where a cancer surgeon and a very insightful researcher, Dr. Nancy DeMore, acted like a detective when it comes to testing possible treatments for breast cancer. And she joins another researcher to test an ancient revered substance on breast cancer and colon cells in the medical center there. I'm talking about frankincense, but we know it today as Boswellia, B-O-S-W-E-L-L-I-A, genus. It's actually a tree resin, the kind of sticky substance that if you took a piece of bark off a tree, in the healing process, this resin would come forward. It's highly valued throughout history and even today as a trade product, medicine, and has a very sensual fragrance. It's also treasured as a religious incense to strengthen members both spiritually and physically. And another South Carolinian researcher named Ingrid Bonilla happened to study the same exotic spice in the lab and has researched frankincense as a treatment for breast cancer cells. And here's what they said. It's nice to see doctors who think outside the box. Out of all of the physicians that I talked to about this, Dr. DeMore was the only one who was interested in moving forward. This is the other doctor. DeMore says boswellic acid, the extract from the Indian frankincense, that resin, can help by reducing inflammation. And interestingly, the chemical structure of boswellic acid is similar to other anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen. And boswellia is very important for breast cancer treatment. So they did a lot of work on this. And they said, quote, tumor from the biopsy that was taken to make the diagnosis of cancer before treatment will be compared to the tumor taken after surgery, after treatment. This will allow us to assess whether taking Boswellia changes the biology of the tumor. Other research shows that it does because of the plants common have, like foxglove plant, is one of the most common examples. You wouldn't take it normally because it's a poisonous plant in the wild, but it actually stops cardiac arrhythmias as a drug. And so there are many different spices, herbs, and plant substances that have strong healing power. Probably at the top of the list would be black cumin seed oil, and then your curcumin from turmeric, because they're able to stop blood vessels from growing in tumors, which is one of the ways they help save people's lives who have cancer. So I'm glad to see they're doing this research. When the results are finished, I'll share it with you. But just the idea that they're willing to venture outside the orthodoxy of using chemotherapy and try something else is very promising. So good for them. Now, we all know that chronic stress kills. It increases our risk of a heart attack and stroke. It also prematurely ages our brain. Stress is pro-inflammatory. That hurts all of our body. Brigham Young University did a study published in Nature Scientific Reports. And what they found was that we all know that a poor diet is unhealthy. Yes. But a Brigham Young study finds that stress is just as harmful to our bodies as a bad diet. This is interesting because last night I did a lecture where I showed my lifetime of work of how I come up with a formula for determining your likely outcome, approximately how long you're going to live, or how quickly disease will occur, how quickly you will die from the disease, and also how you can prevent that disease. Each one a piece of the puzzle. And I was telling them that diet and stress and exercise are virtually equal. And I tested it because I gave 500 people in one clinical trial, and I'm sure someone listening might have been in that trial. It was over at the Jewish Center on West 86th Street. It took 6 months. I met with everyone every week for 6 months. And one group got stress input, another group got dietary input, another group got exercise input. And the last group got, there was one other, but one group got only belief system, meaning what do you value, what do you believe in life? What do you live for when you wake up in the morning? Are you going through a ritualized routine? Are you going to think out of the box? Are you going to do something different? Is fear limiting you? And if so, in what ways? But nothing about diet, exercise, or nutrition at all. And then the last group got everything. And the first three groups fared absolutely equally. And none were completely restorative, meaning not diet, the perfect diet, not the exercise, not the stress management, in and of themselves was able to reverse disease. But the belief system by itself did remarkably high results, and put all together, that's when you're able to have cures. So here's what it's saying right now. That was 20 years ago. This is Brigham Young University saying the same thing. Quote, that stress impacts the gut microbiota and the microorganisms vital to digestion, metabolic health, change to look like the mice have been eating a high-fat diet. Stress can be harmful in a lot of ways, but this research is novel in that it ties stress to female-specific changes in the gut microbiota. We sometimes think of stress as purely psychological phenomena, but it causes distinct physical changes, end quote. So that's confirming, at least on two parts, and you would find the same thing with exercise. So all those pieces come together. Now, a little mineral, not a lot, 15 to 25 milligrams a day, can help regulate your pH levels in the brain. And this is from the Center for Molecular Medical Research in Norway. And they discovered that zinc binding plays an important role in the sensing and regulation of pH in the human brain. And this is one of the first studies of its kind. And that means when we inhale, oxygen is distributed via our red blood cells to every living cell of our body. And human cells use oxygen to produce what is called adenosine triphosphate, or ATP. That's where you get your actual energy. Visualize throwing a log into a burning stove, and it creates more heat. Well, the molecule ATP, that's what fuels vital processes in the cell, like maintaining the electrical potential across the membranes of the cells that allow you to think and feel. So ATP, adenosine triphosphate generation, is directly linked to citric acid cycle, which leads to the complete breakdown of nutrients. And this process ultimately generates carbon dioxide, or CO2, as the final waste product, which when we exhale, is taken out of the body. However, before we can exhale that excess CO2, this vital molecule is involved in one of the most important biological functions in our body. It regulates our pH in our cells. And this process is incredibly important. Let me give you an example. If the pH in and around our cells is lower than 6.8 or higher than 7.8, then we're in danger of dying due to cell death and tissue damage. When you're on a highly acidic diet, alcohol, sugar, meat, your pH is going to be much lower, like 6.8 or below that, which is one of the reasons people die much sooner and the systems break down much quicker than if their pH was 7.2. An example of how important pH levels are to our health is demonstrated in the fact that pH levels in the blood from the umbilical cord are always tested in newborn babies. A low pH value is correlated with a low oxygen supply during birth, which can lead to severe brain damage. So when in water, CO2 forms bicarbonate, or HCO3, and it's transported by specific transport proteins across the cell membranes. Now, how these transport molecules sense what the pH value is inside the cell has never been answered. However, work performed by scientists found that zinc interacts with the proteins that facilitate the transport of HCO3 through the membranes. And the zinc binding, therefore, plays an important role in the sensing and regulation of cellular pH, in particular in the transporters found in the neurons of the human brain. So that's just one more tiny but extremely important piece of the puzzle of life. It's the first study that directly associates zinc binding with bicarbonate transporters, and hence allowing you to be able to breathe, exhale, have energy in your cells, and specifically energy in your brain. That was published in Scientific Reports, by the way. And selenium, that's a really important mineral. You don't need it much, 200 micrograms a day. But most people don't have that, even that tiny amount, because the American diet is so deficient in important nutrients. Now, according to University of North Carolina, selenium, when you don't have enough, is tied to deadly viruses. Selenium is now recognized as indispensable for maintaining great health. Less well known are the frightening implications of selenium deficiency. Now, groundbreaking research, at least my opinion, has demonstrated that shortages of this mineral can play a role in the emergence of new and dangerous viral strains, could even trigger epidemics. Now, we know that in the United States, every year, there's about 100,000 people hospitalized for influenza viruses, and 20,000 will die of its complications. It has never been completely dealt with as it should be, and especially when it comes to selenium helping stop this process. Selenium exists naturally in our soil. It's also found in our bodies, and it performs biological functions. It helps regulate metabolism. Selenium manages normal growth. It orchestrates reproduction. It neutralizes free radicals, and it defends you against infections. Now, selenium is a component of glutathione peroxidase, the body's master antioxidant, and is incorporated into at least 25 different proteins. So selenium neutralizes free radicals, and free radicals cause you to age. Free radicals damage your cell. Free radicals are the number one cause of disease. Cancer, arthritis, dementia, it's the number one cause. And when selenium is involved, it renders many of these free radicals harmless within your body. And as a constituent of glutathione, selenium helps protect your cardiovascular health by combating the oxidative fats and reducing the stickiness of blood platelets, therefore helping you prevent a stroke, but it also helps to neutralize toxins. So we're not eating enough fruits and vegetables. We're not eating grains. We're not eating onions and mushrooms and things that contain selenium. So just get your selenium and live a longer life, because it's just one of those things that work. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. Please stay with us.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you who to sock it to. It's your thing. Do what you want to do.
We like to keep everyone up on the environment. To all the people in Ireland, to a medical family of five physicians that listen every day and have for years, to all the great people of Ireland, we are aware of your suffering today because of that terrific, powerful storm you were hit with yesterday and today. Lots of people drowned, roofs blown off, and because they weren't prepared for it. One more reason why extreme weather events can happen anywhere in the world, anytime, and are. And that's why we should be spending a lot of time and attention on what to do about it. Interesting, I tried to help our sister station yesterday, as I do every day, but in a fundraising, and we offered, I was asked, didn't I do a webinar recently on what to do when disaster strikes with fires and the very things we're experiencing now. I talked about 2 months ago when I did this, before the hurricanes and before the fires. And yet I projected the likely outcome that this would happen. What did? And I'm projecting a lot worse happening. I'm projecting Category 5 hurricanes hitting New York and other places, and it will devastate us. I'm also saying there's certain places in the world we shouldn't live at all in the future. And that's almost 70% of Africa. Right now there's 160 million people who are having to cope with starvation, crops not growing, the land, the dirt is so hot, seeds are not germinating, loss of water supply, a disease and pestilence that comes with microorganisms able to, let's say the resistant ones survive, but insects are now coming north. They're coming from warmer climates where they have lived for millennia into higher climates. They're now seeing beetles, the spruce beetle, killing tens of millions of spruce trees right up the east coast of the United States. And unless you get up in the air and fly over with a plane at a low altitude, you wouldn't notice this. But it's happening. So another thing that's happening is this. We have a big, beautiful, magnificent, natural phenomena, Yellowstone National Park. If you've never been there, I highly recommend it. But according to USA Today, as reported by Jake Johnson in Common Dreams, that USA Today, quote, indicates the supervolcano resting beneath Yellowstone National Park may blow sooner than thought, an eruption that could wipe out life on the planet, end quote. And USA Today's Matthew Dibel notes that Arizona State University researchers have, quote, analyzed minerals in fossilized ash from the most recent mega eruption and found changes in temperature and composition that had only taken a few decades. Until now, the magazine reported, geologists had thought it would take centuries for the supervolcano to make the transition, end quote. Quote, the discovery which was presented at a recent volcano conference comes on top of a study that found that ground above the magma reservoir in Yellowstone had bulged by about 10 inches in 7 years. Scientists believe that the volcano's last super eruption took place 631,000 years ago, and they thought that this would not happen again for another 100,000 years. Now, no one is trying to put a time frame on the next eruption, but, quote, this is according to Hannah Shamblou of Arizona State University, shocking how little time is required to take a volcanic system from being quiet and sitting there to the edge of an eruption. So I believe that what we should do is get all the leading experts in the world to go there, do the studies, and give us an idea of what they see the likely eruption cycle time to be. So either we could relax and not be concerned, or we should start looking at what is possible and how people would survive the outcome. People would survive if you had adequate warning, there wouldn't be any casualties from the initial eruption. But it's not the initial eruptions that's the problem. It's the ash that goes in the air, blocks the sun. In effect, could be similar to a nuclear winter, and where nothing would grow. Well, nothing would grow now, but we have the technology and we have the knowledge and skills that we could create ways of creating artificial light that is full spectrum, even though it's created artificially. We can create full spectrum and have things grow in massive quantities. There are solutions to every one of these problems, providing that you acknowledge the seriousness of the problem. As I mentioned yesterday, in California, no one is taking responsibility for the fact that people lost their lives, they lost their homes, all their possessions. Most will not be able to get insurance to rebuild. But why didn't anyone say, how did these people end up building in a place that every single study would have shown was not sustainable because of its high heat, ferocious winds, sometimes can go from 50 to 60 miles an hour, and is in a perpetual drought where everything is bone dry all the time? Plus, California's had more trees, over 100 million, die from beetle infestation than any other state in the United States. And those dry trees now, those are just waiting to burn. And then you're in permanent burn status. Now, no one put anything that would protect these people. A few examples. Let me show you how simple the solutions are. First, you have outside independent environmental planning experts say, is this a reasonable place for 1,000, 5,000, 50 people to live? And they'll say yes or no. And why? Then you have open public debates so the public can have a chance to hear someone that is not there to advocate for the developers, for the hedge funds, for the people who are there just to make money off of it. or the politicians that you can never trust. So at least we know the truth. Then if it is yes, you can live here, then how can we live there? So if there is a problem, you minimize the damage. Well, you could put in a permanent irrigation system, meaning that you run the irrigation system to the fullest extent and 2 miles beyond where your property line is. So you have a 2 mile perimeter where there's 100% coverage of irrigation, and not a small irrigation, not a quarter inch, but like 2 inch. You get a 2 inch irrigation system, you turn it on, it's going to flood the whole area. If you flood the area, you're not going to have that grass burn. Then you make sure every house has to have a fire system on the outside. Right now, there's no requirement in America to have any fire system on the outside of a building. It's only on the inside. And it's not on residential compounds. You make it mandatory. And it's not expensive. I'm doing it. You enclose your whole house, and you can't even see it, with a sprinkler system. So when there's a certain heat index, or there's a fire alarm, or you can manually do it, override it, you can turn it on, and your entire roof, your entire sides are completely saturated with water. And you do the same thing on the inside. So yeah, you might get something wet, but the house is going to be standing, and you're not going to be killed. Every person in that development must have, by law, a trailer with a hitch on your vehicle. So therefore, when you have a notion that something's wrong and you know you can evacuate, you have a list made, it's on your refrigerator, everyone in the house is aware of it. If there's an alarm, you immediately take these items in this order and you put them on the trailer. You just pre-prepare. And that way, you save the things that are most important. You save whatever's important to you. With each person it's different, but at least you save your insurance papers, your business papers, your passport, your driver's license, your cash, your jewelry, your family photos, everything that you think is important, but at least you plan for it. All that will take less than 5 minutes from the time an alarm goes to get out. Remember when, at least I remember in my grade school, high school, they'd have fire drills. Well, there was a reason for it. Why shouldn't we have some kind of drill today if people are living in a known and proven fire-prone area, to have signs, lit signs, that if the fire department by satellite will know which area is most susceptible for people to get hurt in, and which is most likely they can escape from. So you have a big sign, and it flashes, and you go that direction. Another sign's red. You don't go in this direction. Right now, with the fires in California, nobody knew which direction to go. And a lot of people didn't leave their homes. And they didn't have fire extinguishers. They didn't have fire systems. Inside, outside, they had made no plans. They lost everything. And the developers weren't held accountable for developing in an area that they knew they shouldn't have developed in. And the banks knew that they shouldn't have financed the developers. And the hedge funds and equity partnerships. No one seemed to care about anything except being in a place that was not sustainable. So you have to hold the media responsible for not exposing it, the politicians for abiding by the developers for allowing themselves to put money or profits ahead of human safety. No different than if you build in a flood zone, or if you build near an earthquake fault, or if you build any place where there's a high probability of danger or damage. And that discussion isn't being happened anywhere now. So the likelihood is, whoever has insurance will rebuild the same house in the same place, and then it's going to repeat itself. So I'm simply suggesting that not just for California and the unfortunate victims there, but let us not any longer engage in intentional neglect because it does not suit some idea or dream we have of where we want to live. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Backfield in motion, yeah, I'm gonna have to penalize you. Backfield in motion, baby, you know that's against.
I'd like to welcome all of you from all over the world. My guest on the line right now is a political analyst, a historian of cultural ideas, a journalist, a columnist for The Guardian, and a former columnist for Harper's Magazine and The Wall Street Journal. He's currently the founding editor of The Baffler, and his area of writing includes politics and propaganda and mainstream media and economics. And he is Thomas Frank, PhD, and his most recent is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, which takes the Democratic Party's betrayal of its social contract with the average American to task. He attended the University of Kansas and the University of Virginia, and he received a doctorate in history from the University of Chicago. His website is tcfrank.com and the Baffler, BAFFLER.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Mr. Gary Knoll, it's nice to be back.
There are many who are making the claim that the Democrats are making a comeback, and this is a good thing after less than a year of runaway GOP draconian behavior, and the further degradation of what remains of any democratic principles in the nation, and the rising fears of authoritarianism or even fascism. So surely liberals have a much better way of looking at life because they can celebrate as we watch the Republican Party fragment and implode. On the other hand, shouldn't we be looking at this realistically? Is it not the case that if there is to be any resurrection of the Democratic Party, it is ultimately due to the abject failure of the Republicans to enact policies that favor people over corporate and banking interests, and not anything the Democrats have done that truly benefits Main Street Americans? Your thoughts, please.
Well, geez, that's a big question. Let's start with the Republicans. And yes, it does look for, you know, you read the newspapers, and these people appear to be, you know, incompetence on wheels. You know, they don't know what they're doing. And when they, you know, they can't get anything done through Congress. And, you know, President Trump is this sort of, I don't know what to say that hasn't been said already, you know, whether you want to call him this colossal liar or this stupendous idiot, or I mean, it's extraordinary what's happening right now. But the point I want to make is that this doesn't necessarily mean that the Republicans are done for. I mean, these guys have been on a kind of amazing winning streak for quite some time now, and if you ask me, they shouldn't have done that either. You know, this is a party that should have been wiped out after the financial crisis, sort of destroyed their, you know, you were talking earlier about, you know, the people that have underwritten the construction of houses in California that shouldn't be where they are. Yeah, those people were doing that all over America. And when that all came crashing down, that should have really been the end of this philosophy and the end of this party. And instead, they have come back. They've come roaring back in this incredible way, and they are in a state of triumph right now. It looks on the surface like disarray and folly, but they're in a state of triumph. They have more state legislatures than they have had since the 1920s. They have control of both houses of Congress. This is, you know, it's unprecedented in our lifetimes, anyway. The kind of control these people have got. They run a man for president. Listen, I mean, think about this for a second. They run this guy, Trump, for president last year. He's never run for public office before, not for any public office. His campaign manager is this, you know, this character, Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon has never managed a campaign before, not even for someone running for mayor. And they're going up against Hillary Clinton, who is former first lady, the wife of one of the ablest politicians, you know, in recent history. She's advised by the smartest people in Washington, D.C. She has plenty of Republicans on her side, not just Democrats, but plenty of Republicans come to her convention. And she outraises Trump. She raises more money than Trump, the billionaire, 2-1. She outspent him 2-1. She was running rings around him with TV commercials. And he still won. There's something going on in this country, Gary Noel, that's that you know, we're only beginning to understand. And just denouncing Donald Trump and talking about what a imbecile he is, you know, and I like to do that as much as the next guy, but just saying that stuff doesn't really get us to the heart of what's wrong. How's that for a beginning?
That's a good opening. I think you're denigrating imbecile when you compare Trump to an imbecile. I mean, there's a whole new synonym we need for him.
Yeah, really, because he's this is what gets me about him, and I've never met the man, and I don't really understand him. I haven't. I make no claim to, you know, have any insight into his personality or anything like that. But that he was, that he seems to be such a fool, but was in fact able to pull this off last year is kind of amazing, and I really still don't understand it.
Let me share a thought and see if this makes any sense to you. I had the good fortune in my life to live in some small communities. We're in West Virginia, Steubenville, Ohio, Wheeling, West Virginia, Katanning, Pennsylvania, among them. And whenever I travel to do the documentaries, like Poverty, Inc., which spent almost 6 years traveling throughout the United States on a regular basis, I speak with people from all walks of life, but mainly working people, the poor, homeless vets. And what I found was that they were believing whoever was in power at the time or getting into power. So if it was Ronald Reagan wanting jobs in America, they believed him, because already by the early 1970s, the corporate raiders were already decimating jobs in the United States, and the green mailers before them. So by the time the equity partners got on board and the hedge funds got on board and the big gigantic pension funds started to give money to these people to go out and make as much money as they could for their members and retirees or future retirees, the ethics of how they made that money was a secondary consideration. No one thought about, okay, our stock value went up, we got our dividends, how did that money actually come to us? And that was a big cognitive disconnect. Make money,
but they're learning now, aren't they? I mean,
yeah, but look who you trusted, and look what the consequences. So anyhow, these people were not either Republican or Democrat, the vast majority. They simply wanted some guarantee that they would have a job to take care of the basic necessities of their life. They were betrayed by Reagan, Bush Sr., by Clinton, by Bush Jr., by Obama. And so it wasn't that they see Trump as being, except some a relatively small core who are radicalized to his personality, but most people just thought, well, everyone else came and promised and lied, and this guy is getting in their face and claims he's going to clean up the swamp, and they have no power whatsoever. When you're sitting unemployed, you're taking an opiate just to get out of the pain of life, or you're drinking out of the pain of life, but you don't have a job to get out. You don't have any savings. You got debt, and your kids are overweight. Everything's wrong in your life. If someone says, I'm going to get in their face, you don't care what his politics are. All you care is he's going to do it. And that is the mistake, I believe, one of the mistakes Hillary made and the Democrats made, is they assumed that anyone who was voting for Trump was a stupid, redneck, illiterate person, and was whatever she called them.
Deplorables.
Deplorables. And boy, the last thing you want to hear when you're at the bottom end of everything is that you're also deplorable, also being poor, being a working homeless person. And they haven't considered those people, and the Democrats, I don't believe, have given one piece of legitimacy to their pain when they had a chance, when they had power, to change the circumstances, and they failed at it for whatever their reasons. Your thoughts?
Oh, wow. Again, great question. I really like your description. I think that is exactly right. And I don't think Hillary really understood what a mistake she was making using that word deplorables, because those people were very sensitive. to the sort of social pecking order, in addition to the economic pecking order. We're there at the very bottom. And then to tell them that they're also, you know, that their manners are deplorable. I would add one more thing to your description of the sort of tactical mistakes the Democrats made. They made a lot of them, but one of them was to assume, and they still assume this, by the way, that everybody that voted for Trump shares the man's bigotry. And Trump is clearly a bigot in all sorts of ways against all sorts of different groups. But that's not the only reason. That's not the reason many people voted for him. I think your description is, I think a lot of people voted for him despite his loathsome, the things that he said about women, the things he said about Iraq war veterans, the things he said about Mexicans and Muslims. I think a lot of people voted for him despite that stuff, not merely because of it. And what you said about that he's promising to get in the face of of the powerful, that's exactly right. And, you know, it wasn't hard when I was writing about the election while it was actually happening, while the campaign was in progress. It wasn't hard to turn on YouTube and watch some of Trump's videos where he would actually use the phrase working class, and he would talk about, by the way, his obsessive concern. He talked about it in every speech. Was trade deals, you know, especially NAFTA, because that's the one that everybody remembers. But he talked about a bunch of other ones, too. And here's Hillary, and she doesn't really have a response for that. I read her memoir recently, and she still doesn't have an answer for that. She still doesn't even talk about that. But to take a step back a little farther, so the subject of Listen Liberal, which came out well before the election, was how Democrats fell out of touch with the very people that you just described. How did that happen? And it's a historical process that goes way back, but the main figure in that story is Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, who, you know, was hailed as being a new Democrat, was doing things differently than traditional Democrats. And the main thing he was doing differently than traditional Democrats is he was reorienting the party away from the concerns of working class people. This is not me making this up or reading between the lines. They were real open about this at the time. And you go back and look at his great achievements. And when I say his great achievements, these are the things that his admirers actually would say were his great achievements. And the first one was NAFTA, which was, of course, fought by organized labor, and which the people you just described, sort of working class people in the areas that you have visited, they all know what the impact of NAFTA was. They all know that it tilted the playing field permanently in favor of management. They all know that because their bosses tell them that, and their unions tell them that. And everybody knows that. And that's a deed of Bill Clinton. It's also a deed of George Bush Sr., you know, who negotiated the treaty in the first place. But it's Bill Clinton that got it passed through Congress, and people remember that, and they're bitter about that. But you look at his other great achievements, deregulation of Wall Street, welfare reform. You know, these are things that hurt those people. Deregulation of telecoms. All of the long list of stuff that this guy did. He meant to signal, and did signal, that the Democratic Party was changing, that it was no longer this kind of party of blue-collar voters, that instead it was a party that was friendly towards the banks. And the banks got that message, they understood that message, and they climbed on board. And they did the same with Hillary, and they did the same with Barack Obama. And, you know, to make a very long story very short, you look at Barack Obama's really, I think, tepid, weak response to the financial crisis, the sort of turning point that I mentioned earlier, his response to the financial crisis, where he should have been, you know, he would have been a kind of Rooseveltian hero had he gotten tough with Wall Street, and he declined to do it. Why did he decline to do it? Because that's not who the Democrats are any longer. And I think voters understand that to some degree.
I appreciate your insights in that answer, Thomas. Let me share a human story. back before Bill Clinton became president, I was asked to come to a fundraiser in New York by arguably New York's leading liberal Democratic family. And I had very close friends. And I told them what I knew about Bill Clinton as governor. I'd done a major investigation on him. And they thought that was just impossible that he was that corrupt as a governor. And I said, now, mind you, what he was as governor is going to be amplified as if he were on steroids when he's president, because if he got away with it with the machine he has around him. And I said, Bill Clinton is one of the most charismatic and charming people that has ever been in there. You would have to go back to Jack Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, to find someone who was equally charismatic. And people accept the charisma first. How many times have you seen a presidential debate and someone says, that person sounded presidential or they looked presidential? I don't care how they sound or look. What were they actually saying? What was the content of their message? And so then the meeting came, and the only people who were there, and it was packed, were people who were the leading liberal Democrats in New York. And they were there to write the big check. I'm talking about big checks. And afterwards, we spent the entire Sunday afternoon, my friend, who organized all this, who's one of, and still is, one of the big fat cats of the Democrat liberal community, and on a personal level is an extremely genuinely nice human being. And we rarely ever talk about politics because I'm coming from a progressive point of view, looking for the truth without having to moniker my association with any given group. And we spent must 7 or 8 hours. And so I asked it, the revelation was in one question. Why are these people here and what do they want? My friend said, well, it's simple. Whoever gives the biggest check to the Clintons is going to get a place, a preferred alignment. Preferred alignment.
That's the word he used?
Meant, yes, preferred alignment. And that's exactly what happens. So if you want to do business in a country you cannot now do for some regulation, you'll get it. If you want an ambassadorship, you'll get it. Because remember, we never have qualified ambassadors. These are business people who bundle the largest amount of money. I mean, they can't even speak French and they get an ambassadorship or Japanese,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We have thousands of highly qualified, extremely intelligent, and completely diversified foreign diplomats. Not one ever gets an ambassadorship. So here we get these people who are mismatched to the culture, but they laid out the money. Now they go get to live in an exotic location for a period of time. But then the second part of the answer was, I said, they gave me that, and I said, well, I said, but this man is bringing a whole new way of looking at liberalism. It's going to be neoliberalism. And the person said, everyone at that party is engaged in neoliberalism with a smile. And as long as you're smiling, they'll accept you. If you came in taunting, pushing, cajoling, threatening, they'll repel you. Clinton smiled to the AFL-CIO and its membership. That's how he partly got elected, and to the women's movement and to the poor. Did you ever see a man who tried to be as black as Bill Clinton? And he was called the first black president, if you remember.
That's
and
right.
We can joke about it in one sense, but he knew that if he made enough promises to the minority populations in this country, including women, he would be the man who would be overwhelmingly charming and sincere. And we as Americans are extremely vulnerable to someone who shares sincerity. And today, when we look back at everything he actually did to the minorities, and the incarceration,
oh my goodness,
how many blacks he put in prison,
how
many
people were brought. I was going to mention that,
Could you follow up and conclude our program today with giving us the truth of what someone is versus what we want them to be, and then when they don't match our with their performance, how we're disappointed?
Well, okay, so Bill Clinton is a really interesting case study, and in writing Listen Liberal, you know, I was sort of revisiting all the literature of the Clinton years. And when I say that, by the way, I mean the serious literature, prestigious books, not the right-wing hate literature, you know, where they would call him a drug dealer and call him a murderer and stuff like that. I was reading books by his fans. And this was another thing that they admired him for was the crime bill of 1994, which had this sort of awful coda where he basically signed into law the crack versus powder cocaine sentencing disparity. I mean, it had already existed, but it was going to be overturned unless he took action, and he took that action. And this was over the, against the wishes of many of his supporters who were saying, you know, look, that is it's a racist provision. It's a terrible thing. It's the reason that you have mass incarceration in this country. And what astonishes me about Bill Clinton, if you go back, this is all in Listen Liberal, the events are just one right next to the other. He would give speeches deploring mass incarceration and then went and signed this bill like a few days later. And that blows my mind. How could a man do that? And then that's, you know, so much of the population just then, you know, quickly forgot about that, even as these people were locked up in kind of unprecedented numbers. Kids, by the way, you know, this is the stuff that this is what I am describing is one of the most shameful and horrible episodes in law enforcement in this country's history. And it was largely forgotten, you know, because other things intervened, Monica Lewinsky and stuff like that. But I wrestled for quite a while with this problem. Like, what kind of man is able to do that? To say that he's against something, then sign it, then go back to saying that he's against it. You know, I don't get that. It doesn't make sense to me. And thankfully, I think some sense of reason is finally returning to our politics, that no one is proud of that anymore. You know, his biographers were proud of that back in the 1990s when these things were actually going on. Nobody is proud of that now. And in fact, Hillary Clinton was often embarrassed on the campaign trail by protesters who would bring this up. But the way the Clintons thought about minority voters and the way they thought about organized labor and the way they thought about many different groups, they had a phrase they would use: they have nowhere else to go, is what they would say. They have nowhere else to go. So, you know, we can do whatever we want to them. We can treat them however we want. We can, you know, ruin their lives. We can destroy, you know, the manufacturing base of this country, and it doesn't really matter because those voters have nowhere else to go. The people that we're competing for is the money. And, okay, so I wanted to take you in a happy direction, Gary Noel, but now I see I have taken you in a really dreadful and awful direction.
No, you haven't. You, once again, as you tend to do, you shine a light on a problem and you don't sugarcoat it, and that's what we need at this time. If we're to stop buying into people's personality and promises and look at their actual records and hold them accountable, or at least have more power to hold people accountable than what we have in the past. And I really appreciate what you do, Thomas. So thank you very much for this conversation.
You're welcome, Gary. And anytime you want to talk, I'm here.
Good. His newest book is Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, Thomas Frank, PhD. I'm Gary Noel. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.